Welcome to the Driving Eureka podcast, where we share ideas and advice for helping you find, filter, and fast track big ideas. Let's go! Hi, I'm Trip Babbitt, advisor to global organizations on the Deming philosophy and host of the Deming Institute podcast.
And I'm Doug Hall, inventor, speaker, teacher, and whiskey maker. I'm also the founder of the Eureka Ranch and author of the Driving Eureka book.
This is the Driving Eureka podcast, episode 4. This week in segment 1, our feature story is How to Change Your Destiny. In segment 2, the Driving Eureka book excerpt is about Doug's interview with Dan O'Day about the 5 false innovation cures. And finally, the Brain Brew Whiskey Academy segment is Doug's promise to take us through the step-by-step process to achieving meaningful uniqueness. And also in that segment, we'll talk about the craft cocktail recipe. And this week's recipe is the jalapeno julep cocktail. Doug, let's start with how do we change our destiny?
Well, so this happened. This is real world stuff that happened. And sometimes, just the stimulus of these things, they get into my head and I can't stop. And let me just set the scene. The scene was what's called a Eureka Accelerator. And this is a format that we've grown to over nearly 40 years here, where you spend a day inventing and then 3 days doing very rapid cycles of development. So to resolve a lot of the early death threats. And so it's a very, very intense. It compresses 9 months into 4 days. Okay, so very, very intense. And before we begin these sessions, we measure the raw material, the people that we're working with. And, of course, we're not measuring how strong they are or how healthy they are. We're measuring their mindset. You know, how urgent do they see it to do innovation? How much courage to take action do they have? And what is their, how much do they collaborate, quality of work? Some pretty straightforward questions, but pretty direct questions. And we don't do this to be mean, and we don't do this to beat people up. And we tell people it's not a measure of these people. It's a measure of the culture they are within. This is how they're feeling. Because what we have found over 40 years is that the mindset of the people coming into the effort to innovate is one of the biggest determinants of what happens. Now, for a long time, our rule was if your culture was not right, we wouldn't work with you. Basically, I'm going to reject this raw material. I can't help you.
That's a lot of rejection.
It wasn't bad.
Oh, really? Okay.
In 1993, uh-huh. It wasn't bad. 95, it wasn't bad.
Oh.
But it's gotten worse and worse. And with each drop of the stock market, it takes another leap downward, basically. And so 2000, it dropped. 2008 dropped. And it's gotten pretty ugly. And so we got in after 2000 in there, I started looking at it. And I said, well, wait a minute. There aren't going to be anybody left to work with. And besides, you know, what kind of emergency room only deals with healthy people, you know? I mean, if I cried out loud, they're coming to see you because they got a problem.
And the pipeline's drying up.
Well, and it's your job, damn it. You know, don't complain. You're supposed to be a damn expert at this stuff.
No whining.
I've got a problem. That's right. Absolutely no whining. I've got a problem. I can't innovate. And you're telling me, no, you're not good enough for me to work with you. Well, you a-hole. That's like stupid. So that's what really set off a lot of the quantitative research that ended up in particular, it was Jumpstart Your Business Brain that really did a surge of data of measurement, because we had to reinvent ourselves quickly so that we could work with whatever organization was coming in, whatever organization. And whatever the state of mind, we had to make our systems robust enough to handle variances in raw material. That's the job. That's the task. Get over it. If you don't want to do that, retire. And so we did. And the key metric for this, Dr. Chris Storman and I did the fundamental research on this, is we took 6,000 teams and measured them in the act of creating. Then we looked at it against the pre-data and the post-data and built up a lot of the stuff that is in now Driving Eureka in the book and that. And so, but one of the things that we learned was when you measure their results, you have to benchmark them. And you make it very simple because, you know, it's not math. A lot of people aren't math people. So you make it red, yellow, green. Everybody gets red, yellow, green. And the results have gotten worse and worse. Now, somebody said, well, Doug, just recalibrate for today's people, you know, which will then make some of them good. But I said, but they're all horrible. And they go, you're just being severe. I said, but we've got to get back to this world exists. And with small companies, I still see that world. So it's not like it's an impossible world. It's just how far down things are. I mean, people are your old guys. It's worse today. No, I got data. I got data that shows. I've got the same big Fortune 50 companies 15 years ago and today, totally different companies, totally different companies. So it is different. Factually, that's the data. So what we do is we share this data with the leadership first and talk them through. And in years since the early 90s of doing this, no leader ever says, oh, I'm shocked. That's not my team. You're wrong. They always say, yep, you're right. You're right. That's why we're here. You know, pretty much. They're very positive about it. And so we were in Asia and Maggie Nichols was running the session. I was chief inventor. My job was just to think and do ideas. I've talked. Wicked cool job, by the way. Greatest job in the world as far as I'm concerned. And the state of mind, it showed it was really bad. I mean, the courage to take action, the state of mind, it was really, really, really horrible. And then Maggie Nichols laid out the data and she started a very constructive conversation to get people to express their frustrations and challenge. And she wasn't going to let it get into a pity party. Okay. And then she accelerated the session and got them going and generated a momentum that before they knew it, they were rocking. And the result was they engaged. And the people went big and bold. They really went big and bold. It was amazing. It was amazing, the transformation. And usually you don't see it. And one of our measures of doing it is at the end of the first day, they have to pick some ideas to send out for testing. And usually the team talks big ideas, but at the end of the day, they all become conservative and boring. And the first night, usually the ideas fail, and then they're a little bit better the next day, and next day, and next day. They really, really pushed it. And so, you know, needless to say, at the end of this, you know, they come out of the end really embraced, talking about this new culture. They're going to keep going. They have to go. It was supposed to be a week before we got back. Next thing, you know, literally the next morning as we're flying back, they're sending emails. How can we go faster? I mean, amazing, truly amazing transformation. And so I sat back and I said, what the heck happened? What took a group that over many years would have been just a struggle to go do this and made this difference happen?
So, Doug, you talk about the survey in there. Can you give us a little bit more detail on what the survey is and what kind of what it's measuring? It was a little cryptic for me to try and piece through that.
So we've got a set of maybe I don't know. I guess it's like 30 or 40 questions that we ask, and the questions have. We've got huge databases, hundreds of thousands of respondents in it. So we got really good data on it. And we spent a bunch of time in the beginning making sure the questions couldn't be gamed. I mean, we designed them so they couldn't be gamed. And some of them actually have academic basis for them, psychological measures of where people are. But it's things about agreement to innovate, urgency to innovate. Are they more logical left brain or more artistic right brain as a group or dual brain? It's courage to take action, sufficient resources to get the job done, confidence in, you know, how much time they spend proactive versus reactive, firefighting versus leading, confidence in their ability to create, communicate, and commercialize. I mean, a really pretty in-depth profile. And in fact, if listeners want, Trip, how about if we do this in this episode? We'll set up a special link that they can go to because we set up an RX prescription that uses a lot of the questions, where listeners can go and answer the questions, and it's just for you, it's all confidential, and you can sort of see where you stack up against hundreds of thousands of others out there, and you can get see where you are, and then it has some automated coaching that comes with it that literally gives you some advice, and it's all oriented in a positive way. There's no beating you up on where you should focus and what you could do to really – it's basically your prescription for success, how you can make that better. So we'll set up that link for people.
Oh, okay.
So they can do that for free.
Not free.
What's that?
I said not free.
Yes, this will be free.
Okay. All right. And then, so they're going to be compared against a bunch of other companies. Is there anything you can reveal about other companies that have taken this test or have taken this in the past and how they compared? And it kind of was a preemptor to their future success or failure?
Well, today, almost everybody, unless you're a small business that's owned by the founder, it's almost guaranteed it's not good. But you already knew that. I mean, I didn't have to write a survey to tell you that. You know, I mean, you know the frustrations. But it does point you to places. I can tell you that when we institute training and we take a methodical approach of diffusion of innovation to change the culture, within 6 months, you can see significant improvement across the board. And within 18 months, you can have a pretty remarkable culture that can change. But, you know, you can't change it in a day, and beating people up isn't going to do it. You've got to change the way people are working, change the way people collaborate, et cetera.
Okay. And so you go on in this particular section from Driving Eureka about, you know, what changed the destiny of the group, and you outline these three areas.
Yeah, so my hypothesis, I can't know for sure. This was one event, so let's just be clear about that.
Okay.
I am a mathematician, and so, you know, observing something qualitative is not quantitative, and I'm pretty firm on that. So qualitative gives us hypotheses that then you have to run experiments to prove, and sometimes we can do it with the data because we can look in the data for it. I think three things made this transition from fear to courage and literally changed the culture of these people, which was truly remarkable. And the first was leadership. The leader of the group was fully present. Sometimes we have leaders in the group and they spend half their time on their phone or they spend half their time texting. But this leader was right there. And when the data came out, I happened to be sitting at the table with him. We have small tables, people working at. And he didn't dodge it. He didn't make any excuses. He didn't start asking questions. Could it be? He just said, okay, it is. Now, how can we work this? He just went. And that set the tone. Second thing was patience. Maggie Nichols, who leads the ranch, did just an absolutely amazing job, better than I would ever do, managing the emotional state of the group. I would normally have tried to just charge forward with energy. She let it go easy, let people get some space and get them going. And then she came to me and she said, okay, now I need you to do a little rant. I need you to charge them up. And by holding on and letting the people do it, I think in the past I jump in too quick because I'm like, let's go. She let them go, let them feel it, let them build. And so she had some patience with it, which was quite amazing. And then the third thing was there was real diversity. So this was an international project. There was no culture, no country came close to being 25% of the group. So it was truly a United Nations type thing. I mean, it was or a Toronto school, however you want to think about it. An amazing amount of different people. And so people didn't have a sense of belonging to classically with international projects. You'll have the Europeans against the North Americans against the Asians or, you know, that kind of crap. I mean, there was none of that. They were from all these different countries. And so the group became a group and it became a sense of belonging that, you know, we can be better than this. We are better than this. And so That's what did it. I think, and we could do some analysis to figure out. We could check in particular the diversity in that. Leadership, the leader accepting it and saying, let's go. Patience by Maggie Nichols. She managed the group's psychology, understood it, felt the pulse of it, and had me push a couple of times. And then as the week went on, she turned me from an idea person into a teacher. And so a number of times she said, I want you to teach them this. Teach them this. Hmm. And so whether it was doing the math, doing research, interpreting research, she had me give lectures like we give on, you know, I've given on campus. Because she says they've not known these ways of doing it. And so I want you to just teach. Don't preach. Teach. And I think, you know, that helped. And then lastly, it was the diversity. It was an amazing diversity. And I think, you know, when we model it, we say diversity is an exponential impact on the number of big ideas you create. We had it. And it showed.
That's cool. We're only a few episodes, obviously, into this podcast, but there is a recurring theme that keeps coming up, and I see it in your writing, is you really hit this idea of fear pretty hard. You've mentioned it in this particular article. Why are you gravitating to that in your writing, do you think?
Well, when we modeled, so we took a set of 6,000 teams that we had really good data on, and we measured them every 40 minutes and asked them questions, ridiculous amounts of questions. We told them if they didn't answer the questions, it could screw up the project and cause people scared, so they answered every question. The university now tells me you couldn't ask those kinds of questions as part of the university. So we asked people how much they liked it, and there's a whole pile of things that we did. Long and short of it, what we found is the number of meaningfully neat ideas that really stuck, not just right at the moment, but a week later, et cetera, real solid things. The equation that defined it was stimulus, which was how much stimulus you had. In other words, ideas are feats of association. So we bring in what's called spark decks, and we have unrelated mining, patent mining, insight mining, future mining. There's like six minings. You fill your brain with that. That is raised exponentially to the level of diversity, which is what I just mentioned. The more diversity, the more ideas you get. So that's the numerator. That's the top of the equation. Stimulus raised exponentially to diversity. However, that's the potential to the level that you – and the denominator is fear. Because as fear goes up, the number of ideas goes down. And so when you see a team that has high fear, low courage to take action, then you know it's going to be brutal because they may come up with them, but their ability to kill it will be immense. And so fear is the constraint. It is the key constraint. That's why we do data. That's why we do documented systems. That's why we use data-driven decisions. That's why we do the math early. All of those things, you know, telling people to howl at the moon and be a design creative, that's cute, but that's not going to stick except for the few weirdos. And I'm counting myself as one of those who's really out there on the edge. The majority of the people, 85% are left brain. And we need those people. They're critical because if you're going to make something, if you're going to design something, if you're going to build something, you're going to need those people. So stop giving them lectures. Do it the way they need to do it. Help them.
Well, let's move on to segment two, the excerpt from the Driving Eureka book. In a previous episode, actually it was episode one, we had talked about one of the five false cures. And then later, you did an interview with Dan O'Day. And why don't you talk a little bit about that interview, and then I'll put that recording in after you've talked about Dan O'Day a little bit.
Well, in an earlier episode, we talked about the five false cures about innovation. I talked about the first one. And I thought it'd be fun for people to get the whole set. And so it's kind of a neat way of doing it. This is guy Dan O'Day, who I met many years ago, and he's kind of legendary in the radio business as a teacher. He's taught, when there used to be DJs before there were computerized stations, he taught many of them, in particular comedy, interviewing, voice presence, just a true expert. And he saw, read some of my early books, really found them useful, in particular Jumpstart Your Brain, Jumpstart Your Business Brain, really found them useful. And over the years, we would just show up. I'd be at a place, I'd be asked to speak, and next thing you know, he'd come around the corner and he'd say, yeah, I thought it would be good for you to speak here. And he had contacted and heard that I was doing a new book, and so I'd sent him one of the early galleys. And he said, geez, I'd like to do something for you, Doug. You've helped me a lot. I'd love to do a recording with you that you can use however you see fit. And I thought, well, geez, to get interviewed by him, that'd be pretty cool. And it was different. It was different than many interviews these days because, I mean, here was a throwback guy. And he makes it so effortless in the recording. And he's the one that picked out from the book the five false innovation cures. And he said, this is really important stuff because people could always dish this and say, hey, I don't really need this innovation stuff. We're doing that. And so the interview's about an hour. He covered an amazing amount of ground. So it's well worth listening to while you're exercising, driving or whatever. But the false cures, we thought we'd stick them in here because it's just something different. And it fulfills exactly what we're talking about.
Well, let's listen to Dan and Doug talk about the five false cures for innovation.
Yeah, let's start with, what are the five false innovation cures? Can you explain those, please?
Yeah, so the Driving Eureka book, it really deals with the innovation engineering system. And it's about not just the ideas, but ideas and shipping going. And, you know, against this, we know that you have to innovate. People agree with that. CEOs agree with it. But the issue is they don't know how. The challenge we face is oftentimes they are grabbing at straws that they think to do it. And I call them the five false innovation cures. And it's interesting that you ask about that because literally today I got three different notes from people who've gotten early editions of the book, and they were quoting different ones of these. These are the pains that they're feeling in their organization. So as we go through them, I think we may hit a hot button where people go, oh my God, that's me. That's my problem.
So the first one is?
The first one is if we put in more inspection, metrics, and bigger rewards, then all will be good. In other words, all we got to do is if we measure the outcome and we bribe people to do the job, then they'll innovate. And that's just totally against. I mean, I could stand in a court of law and extrinsic and metrics will not enable somebody to go do great things. It has to come from within. It has to be intrinsic motivation. And the more they measure it in that way, where they're measuring the output as opposed to helping them use metrics as a means to improve the system, then the more they fail.
The idea of measuring outcomes is not new. In terms of measuring outcomes of innovation, how can a veteran manager who has a B-school mindset, and I don't mean that as an insult, but a veteran manager with a B-school mindset, how can that person be expected to evaluate an innovation or even to distinguish it from a new idea or a proposal that is just stupid?
You're catching the nuance here. The output is an innovation pipeline of a lot of ideas. What we want to use is the metrics to help the people improve their method of doing it, improve their ability to evaluate ideas. And what we have found in tracking tens of thousands of ideas is that the way you evaluate the idea on how innovative it is by measuring what we call meaningful uniqueness. And specifically, you show it to potential customers and you get how likely they are to buy it and how new and different they think it is. And you weight them 60-40, purchase and new and different. And this metric will tell you how likely they are to try it, how likely they are to repeat purchase, all things being equal, the awareness that you'll get, the distribution that you'll get, and your ability to get more money for it. I mean, because one of the things we know is meaningful uniqueness correlates with profit margin. People don't want to pay extra, but if the thing does something they can't get anywhere else, they'll pay more.
And do you determine that purely from self-predictive behavior, from asking your customer base, or do you predict it by putting that product out in the market at that higher price and seeing how the market reacts?
Well, you have a lot of ideas and you have to filter them. So we have, in fact, we talk in the book about, or I talk in the book, about five different methods for measuring it, from artificial intelligence systems we have, which will, the computer will read, you write a written description and the computer reads it, to systems that you test with a panel of people inside the company of experts against standardized standards, as well as consumer testing or business to business or whatever it might be, testing out where you can use stuff either with the internet or direct intercept to do it. So that it, but in all of these systems, it's a quantitative measure that you get that is an objective measure that says how meaningfully unique your idea is.
Perhaps this is the contrarian nature that people accuse me of having. It leads me to wonder, does most innovation come from a determined desire to innovate, or does most of it come from an iconoclastic mindset that simply follows what seems natural or better versus the way things always have been?
I think it comes from an intrinsic, the big ideas, the people that come up with big ideas, it comes from within. There's something out there that's bugging them. There is something out there. There's a wrong that they want to right. There's a need that they have to make a difference in a category. And so that mission drives them to go beyond where most people are, which is why one of the things that we've done in the new book versus some of the older books is we talk about using what we call commander's intent, which is a form the military uses for your project missions, where the leader writes a narrative that's designed to inspire people to do great things. Because you've got to get to them emotionally. They've got to want it. You've got to love it. You've got to love it to innovate. It's all too hard. You get beat up along the way. And if you don't love it, it's just not going to happen. And so we try to get the leaders to write that narrative that inspires the people to do great things.
So the first of the five false innovation cures is that more inspection and more metrics and bigger rewards will do the trick. What's the second false innovation cure?
The second one is what I call the big idea hunt. If we just get a bigger idea, all will be good. We just need a bigger idea. The problem is what we're finding, and I followed this for some time, that if we would just give you a bigger eureka at the front, then it would be good. The problem is the development system in most organizations is the killing zone. Two separate studies show that when an idea goes into development, if you do a quantitative sales forecast on what it is, an objective forecast using customer data, when it goes into development and when it comes out, two separate studies show that on average, companies lose half the value during development. I mean, basically, the development process is not developing it into something better. It's like hospice. It's managing the death of ideas. And so ideas are, frankly, and that's trite to say it, but it's not hard to get ideas. What is hard is to take those ideas and in development actually make them better. In a case, what we're finding is instead of a loss of 50%, we're getting a gain of 28% and make them better at the other end. So that
to
you're
what do
improving
you contribute
the ideas.
The loss of that 50% of the value or the effectiveness of the idea?
The silos. So what happens is that the team, the small team that worked on the idea at the front, they were fully engaged. Now as we move it into the silos in our organization, all of these separate departments, they're more loyal to their silo than they are to the mission of the idea. And so they're going to optimize it to make it easy for merchandising, for packaging, for manufacturing, for finance. They optimize for their silo as opposed to for the good of the whole. And they're not to be blamed because it is their mission, and the metrics they're evaluated on their job at the factory is running efficiently. And you bring me something that's going to mess up my factory. Well, dude, I ain't doing that. That's going to mess up my bonus. So they're doing the job that management gave them to do and measured them on, and that job destroys the ideas. And until management understands that, they're going to continue to get their 5 to 10% success rate and declining profit margins that we're seeing globally now for most large companies.
I would think that a common problem would be large, successful companies being presented with genuinely innovative ideas, recognizing the values of those ideas, saying, oh, that sounds great, and then insisting that the bold new ideas be forced to fit into the company's existing culture or belief system.
So they get done the thing. They have a pile of ideas. Say we got a whole stack, and we call them yellow cards. They sort the cards. And on the right hand, they put, okay, this idea, never done that before. Okay, this idea, haven't done it before. They put it to the right. Oh, this idea, that's like something we can do already. Put it in the left pile. Oh, that idea, yeah, that's easy. We'll put it in the left pile. Okay, so our next big idea, let's take the ones in the left pile. The ones that are the exact same stuff as what we're doing, that's what we're going to go do. And so they fail before they begin. They fail before they begin.
So they're drawn to the most innovative of the ideas that they've already done.
That's right. And the ones that they already know how to do. In other words, imagine if you were in Boston back in 17, whenever, and you decided to go to California and you said, I'm not going until I can see exactly how to get there. That's what we're talking about. There's no adventure. There's no spirit of adventure. There's no team signing on and saying, well, I don't really know how to do it, but we'll run some experiments and we'll figure it out. That's just like not allowed. You have to know the answer in most organizations before you begin. This is insanity. It's insanity. And the problem is that the media makes these heroes of the original idea. They make that the big idea, as opposed to understanding what does it take to get the idea out and into the market. And that's what we're doing with system-driven innovation, is we get all of the teams engaged on the mission and we teach them. Because how could they know to do anything other than what they've already done, which is make it fit into that square hole that they've always had?
So the first two of the five false innovation cures are more inspection and metrics and bigger rewards, followed by what you call the big idea hunt. What is the number three false innovation cure?
Well, this one I'm embarrassed on. It's the Skunk Works teams. And I'm embarrassed on it because for many years I did these and would lead them and would encourage people. All we got to do is just take the team and separate them and we can do it. And sometimes, you know, we had pirate flags. They were called Looney Tunes. We were the crazy ones. And we would take a small team and we'd work in a weird place and we would drive them to market very fast. Typically, we do it in a biblical 40 days and 40 nights, you know, get to a test. Okay. And it works. Of course it works. The minute they don't have to work on all the crappy systems that exist in the organization, anybody can do it. It doesn't take much to do it. These are smart people in these companies, by the way. They're smart people. But inside that system, as Deming says, 94% of the problem is the system. Only 6% is the worker. The problem with this is when the idea then goes into the real world adults, into the corporate system, that idea that you shucked and jived with and that you put together with bubblegum and strings and you had it, made it work, all of a sudden has to scale up and you have to use the infrastructure. Well, it's the killing zone again. And what makes it worse is the CEO oftentimes will brag about how brilliant that team was that worked there. We need you to be like that too. Well, everybody's sitting there saying, yeah, right. So guess what they're going to do? I mean, they got the Gatling gun out. You're over. It's done. You have to get the whole to do it. We have to change the culture. We have to enable innovation by everyone, everywhere, every day, as we say. That's what we've got to do. And besides, why should only a few people have fun? Can't everybody have the fun of creating something new? I mean, I don't get it.
So we have two more false innovation cures. What would number four be?
Well, this is very popular today, which is to buy an innovation culture. Well, we'll just buy a group that's very innovative and do it. And a company I talked with recently, I was talking with a senior person, and he said that they'd bought this company. I said, well, how big is it now? He says, oh, it's about $100 million. I said, oh, that's very interesting. I said, what are you going to learn? Oh, he says, they've been very innovative. I said, well, what's the founder doing? Well, the founder, the founder's gone. I said, well, okay, well, the brain's just left. He's drinking umbrella drinks down in Tahiti now. I said, so how much do you think you're going to learn when it's now at the size that it's at? Oh, there's a lot to learn. I said, you learn from zero to $1 million and then to $10 million. That's where the learning is as you go through that process. By now, they've hit such a stage that it's just not going to happen. And anybody that does a startup, you know, their desire to go in and change a corporate culture, it's like a root canal without Novocaine. I mean, they're just not going to do it. This is oil and water. And so it's just not, I don't even understand what they're thinking. I mean, it's just words said by people who've never done it, as best I can tell.
Has there ever been an instance in which a company bought an innovation culture and it succeeded?
Not a culture. There have been some companies that bought. I mean, Apple buying Beats, they kept the founders there and they integrated them together, and that seems to have worked okay. But that's really the exception. Most now, then, you know, you had an innovative group going to an innovative group. So I guess it's not even a fair comparison, actually, as I'm thinking about it. That's a stupid thing to say. But no, not that I know of. Now, if somebody knows one, send me an email. Let me know. Post it. I'd love to know. But I can't imagine that it's ever happened. And Dan, I got to tell you, I think also part of what happens here is that they have a short attention span. You know, by the time they bought it, you know, it's probably been 10 years, 8 years of struggling, and then they were an instant success. And so the company comes in and do it, and they want to have the whole thing happen in 6 months or a year. And they just don't have the patience, even if they did. I mean, we work with companies now, and I've taken a hard stance on it. I mean, you know, we can help them find filter and fast track, or we'll teach them how to do it. And they say, well, I want a culture. I said, okay, you have to sign a 3-year agreement. They said, what do you mean? I said, at least 3 years. And they're like, well, I don't want to do it in 3 years. I said, okay, well, then why don't you work with whoever says they can do it sooner? They said, well, it's never worked. I said, that's right. And part of why you need to have a 3-year commitment is so employees know, because otherwise what they do is you start, you know how this works. You start these things and the employees are going, here they go again, just a matter of time. But when you publicly say this is a 3-year commitment and there's no other option, we're not going back. Different story, different message.
So that's different than, oh, the boss just came back from a conference all excited about this new idea of the week, and next week there'll be another new idea of the week. What's the point?
That's right. That's right.
And the final of the five false innovation cures is?
To be a fast follower. There are people who have the thought that maybe if we just don't innovate too much, if we're not like the first one, if we just follow. The problem with that is the money doesn't show. And there's about 7 or 8 studies in my book, Meaningful Marketing, I cited them, that show that the first gets the lion's share of the profits. And the profits drop dramatically because what the copier can do, the copier has two problems. The first problem they got is that they're late getting there, and the person that was out there first is already going through the experience curve, and they're already starting to save money and become more and more efficient. And you're coming in inefficient at the startup because the startup's always inefficient. So you're behind on that curve. And then the second thing is you don't have a point of difference. And once customers, they will give a reward to the leader unless you have a meaningful uniqueness versus them. People like that's fine. But, you know, the other guys, you know, I mean, they're the pioneer. They did it. They're the best at it. They're just a copy. And besides, you know, if you're an employee, what do you want to do? Oh, let's work for the Xerox company. We copy other people. We don't do anything original here.
Well, I mean, what about all those people who warn that pioneers are the ones with the arrows in their backs?
Well, the data doesn't show that. Let me give you an example. Big ideas versus small ideas. We call them leap versus core. You can put different names, disruptive, whatever. The data shows that both fail at the exact same amount. The difference is when they're big ones, emotionally, it feels like a bigger deal to us. But the reality is little ideas are dying just as fast. It's just not real. The data doesn't show that.
So this is another manifestation of the psychological principle of I remember a football player once expressing it this way. He said that the joy of winning is nowhere as strong as the pain of losing. And so the losses or the mistakes or the missteps stay with us longer, even if they were, they had no more of an impact than the correct new steps.
And I write about the fact there's a lot of studies on this that show exactly what you're saying. And in the academic literature, it's called prevention of a negative. That's the reason why political advertisements are so obnoxious to watch. It is four times more powerful to say, vote for me so that we don't get that thing, than it is to say, this is what I'm going to do. That loss aversion is literally 4x more powerful.
This concludes the Dan O'Day interview with Doug, and it also concludes the second segment. And now we move to the Brain Brew Whiskey Academy segment. Doug, you teased us a little bit last week about giving us a step-by-step process for meaningful uniqueness. So, Doug, let's start there.
So one of the keys to success with anything that you do, whether it's a new product, new service, is your meaningful uniqueness. And the question is, how do you measure it? And you really have to measure it. You got to measure it from the basis of what potential customers perceive to be your meaningful uniqueness, not what you think is your meaningful uniqueness. And the biggest problem that most folks make is they overestimate how spectacular their offering is. They think it's much more unique than it truly is. And so this is critical to making decisions with regards to if you're going to go or not. You know, people think it's very risky to start a new business or to do a new product or service. Well, it is if you're just doing it by judgment. But if you measure it and you quantify it and you make a data-driven decision, it's going to change all of that. Now, when it comes to evaluating, let's take the example of the product because that's the simplest. You can do the same thing with services, but and we can talk about that in a future episode. But let's just keep it simple and stay in products and use, for example, the whiskey business as an example for it because there's a lot of craft distillers and wannabe craft distillers that are listening to the podcast, obviously. So what you have to do is there's two elements that you're going to measure. You're going to measure the idea or the basic concept that you're talking about. In the case of a whiskey, the idea, the packaging, the words that you might say or the pitch you might say with the whiskey. And then, second, you're going to measure the product itself. Is the product? Is the product as good as what the promise is or not as good? Or is the product better? Is the product worse? Where is it? So the way you might do this is the first thing you do is you have to create a concept of the idea. And this can be just a piece of paper or it can be an actual bottle, something that explains what the idea is.
So for your whiskey business, what was the idea? Because to me, I'm getting mixed up in my head between idea and the product itself, if that makes sense.
Good point. Thank you. It was, in our case, we would show them a picture that would show the packaging and then it would have the words that would be the back, maybe the back of the package. So, you know, in one case, it might be an extra smooth, easy drinking whiskey. Mm. And, you know, it might be the idea for the whiskey, and then there'd be the product right there, and you could see what it looks like.
Okay?
Yep. Then what you're going to do, and there's a lot of different ways we can do this, and we've got a lot of digital ways to make it faster and easier, but let's just keep it very simple. We'll do it with paper and pencil. You're going to put together a sheet where you're going to ask two questions. Two primary questions. One question is, how likely are you to buy this product? And the scale runs from 0 to 10. And what I do is I put on the piece of paper 0, 1, 2, 3, up to 10. And over the 0, I put definitely not buy. And over the 10, definitely would buy. Okay. So I'm going to ask you basically on a scale of 0 to 10, where 0 is definitely not buy and 10 is definitely would buy, how likely would you be to buy this product? And people will tell you a number, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, whatever it might be. Then the second question you're going to ask is, How new and different is this idea? Again, on a scale of 0 to 10. 0, not at all new and different. 10, extremely new and different. What those two questions give me, the purchase question and the new and different, is basically meaningful uniqueness. Are you following?
Yep. So the first part of it is how likely I'm going to buy. That's the meaningful part, right?
Yep.
And the unique part would then be how new and different.
That's right.
Okay.
Now, to use those scores, now you've got a number, and you've got a bunch of people that have given you numbers. Then what you're going to do is you're going to average their numbers for each of the questions independently. So you'll average up all the people that responded on the purchase score. You've got threes and eights and sevens and sixes, and you just do the average. You do the same on new and different. Then what the research shows, so we did tracking research of people, and what the research shows, where we asked people questions and then we found out what happened in the marketplace, is that the most predictive measure of what's going to happen in the marketplace is a 60-40 weighting. Basically, 60% on purchase, 40% on new and different. And the way you do that is you take your number from purchase, multiply times 0.6, and you multiply your number on new and different, and you multiply times 0.4, and you add them together.
Okay.
Okay, so 60 and 40.
Mm-hmm.
So now you've got a number, and the number range is anywhere from 0 to 10. So the question is what's that worth? Well, I mean, we've run literally thousands upon thousands of tests, and so we've got norms for all kinds of categories and industries. But as a rule of thumb, a 5 is okay, a 5.0 for the meaningful uniqueness score, the blended number. A 6 is good. It's very good. And a 7 is spectacular. Hmm. And in fact, a 7 versus a 5 is like 250% more likely to generate word of mouth. It's an exponential kick when it goes up like that. With our whiskey business, we're looking for a 7 is our basically go position. And that's a 7 not only for the idea, but a 7 for after they taste it. So we might ask people how likely they are to buy it. Now we say, now taste the product and now score it again. And sometimes it goes up, sometimes it goes down. And we're looking for a 7 in both of them. And if we got that, we've got it. And the reason we want to do that is because as a craft whiskey company, what we don't have the money that the big corporations have. You know, all the big conglomerates that own most of the bourbons and scotches of the world, they're all owned by giant companies from Japan and all this stuff. They got tons of money. We don't have money. So we've got to be more innovative, which means more meaningfully unique. And so while their idea might be the same old stuff they've always done, it's really not that exciting. It's a 5. Ours is a 7. That helps equalize the fact that they got more money than us with regards to getting word of mouth, social media, and all the rest of that.
Okay. All right. And so, you know, as I'm sitting here and I'm thinking, this is one thing I you know, I'm more of an operational background type of guy and not the marketing piece, but I'm thinking, who are you going to test these things? Because, you know, if I just walked into a bar and I started people, there's going to be people there don't like whiskey at all, let's say, and then there's going to be people that have drank it for, you know, 50 years. So how are you figuring out what your frame is for people that you're asking this question to?
So it's a really good question. And let me tell you the mistake that people make. People at big companies, they do this all the time. They will recruit people who already like their brand and ask them if they're likely to buy the new one.
Okay.
I kid you not.
Are they just trying to raise the score? Is that the idea so they can market the answer? Or is that
so that they feel better?
About
it. Yeah. It's to make them feel good. What I teach and what we teach in Driving Eureka and what we teach in our courses that people can take. And by the way, we just, Trip, I wanted to let you know, we just upgraded all of the online course. We've got this online fundamentals course, which is cool. So we'll talk about that in another episode. But it's really cool what the folks have done. But in the courses, what we teach is we teach people to take a more, you know, let's take as a whiskey as an example, basically the general population of people who drink alcohol.
Okay.
And the reason, but you're going to ask them how frequently they drink whiskey. because you're going to look inside the data. And this is where the automated tools help, because it allows you to sort it easily, but you can do it in a spreadsheet too, is you want to see what people who drink whiskey a lot are like and what people who don't drink whiskey are like. Because in the perfect world, like the easy drinking whiskey I was talking to you about, that product actually brings new customers to whiskey.
Okay.
People go, my God, that's the first time I've had a whiskey I actually like. And so if you only test amongst the existing, you're not going to grow the business. And you really want to grow the business, not just swap off share. So you want to look at people beyond just the people that always buy whiskey, because you want to see if can you get some new customers. I remember only 18% of people who drink alcohol in the United States drink whiskey in the last 12 months. 18%. That's it. That's all it is. For all the hype and the rest of the stuff, this is a relatively small amount of people that drink whiskey. And so one of the great opportunities, and in fact, with our Brain Brew Custom Whiskey, one of the great opportunities is you open people up, whether it's through the cocktail experience or whether through custom whiskey, where they can finally get a whiskey that matches them. Because what people in the industry do is they keep making whiskey for the hardcores, as opposed to making it accessible to the new person.
Okay, well, this is very Deming. This is because Ford and General Motors and Chrysler all fought over market share for such a long period of time. Meanwhile, the Japanese came in with not only better quality products, but better cars for purpose. They started in with the smaller cars. So your mindset is, let's expand the pie rather than fight over the pie.
Yeah, I mean, you can call it, the famous book is Red Ocean versus Blue Ocean. I mean, it's the same thing. It's how can you grow the business? And that's what is sort of the key to this whole thing, is what you're looking for. But it really gives you a sense. Now, I'll tell you the killer on this is, it is really hard to get those scores up there. So don't like lose your mind when you get a 4.2, okay? Because it's going to happen. The key is you've got to find a way to very rapidly do this, because you have to do a lot of cycles to make it great. And 95% of the innovations that are done fail, okay, from big companies. It's less so with small companies. But, you know, and the reason they fail is because they weren't that good to begin with. You know, they were a variation, a hair-splitting difference. If you want to make a difference, you got to make a difference. You got to do something that's really different. And that's why I'm frankly so excited about our whole time compression system, because we can use different woods. We can change the pressure cycles. We can create tastes you can't create. You can't create them in a typical barrel aging. That's the benefit. Oh, yes, it's cheaper. And yes, it's faster. Yes. So what? The exciting thing is the amazing new tastes that you're able to create, which frankly is craftsmanship, even though we're using science in a craftsmanship way.
Okay. Okay. Very good. Okay. Well, let's go to the drink here that you talk about, or that you give us the ingredients and how to mix it and everything, which is the jalapeno julep cocktail. And looks like there's quite a story behind that. Why don't you give us a little bit on the story behind this particular cocktail?
Okay, on Netflix, there's a series called The Mind of a Chef. And it was on that show that I met a guy named Edward Lee, who's the chef and owner of Magnolia 610 of Louisville, just down in Kentucky, just down the river from us. And he has a bunch of other restaurants. And there's a number of sequences in there that he does shows. And by the way, just as an aside, you can Google it, it's in YouTube, his fried chicken and waffles recipe will kill. I mean, just make it, and make it exactly as he says. Watch the YouTube video and then download. It's amazing. It is amazing. It is truly amazing. The greatest fried chicken. I mean, the ranch staff doesn't know it, but for the Christmas party this year, I'm making Edward Lee's fried chicken and waffles. And everybody says they got the greatest chicken in the world. Let me tell you, it's especially good to watch the YouTube clip. It's about 3 or 4 minutes, because he really explains why he's doing it. And he is a fanatic about fried chicken. Now, as it turns out, Tim and Sue Hogan, good friends of ours, we were doing the distillery tours. And so we went to Magnolia and we got his cookbook down there. And we also did the tasting menu, which is a blow away. I mean, blow away. And I'm tough on all food and beverage and that kind of things. And so I don't say anything amazing like this unless it's like blows your brains out. And Edward Lee is one of those guys who's doing it, and his cocktails were amazing. And so this summer we made a bunch of his cocktails. And now then I did some riffs on it, because what he likes in spice or what he likes in sweetness is a little bit different. So the jalapeno julep cocktail that I'm going to recommend is the one that I like. It's a little different than his, but it was clearly, it was inspired by him, and it gives a real kick to the mint julep. Mint juleps, I've been to the Derby, you know, sometimes they're just these sugary concoctions that are just not very good, not very good. It is a difficult, I think it's a very difficult drink to get the right balance of the mint and the sweetness and the, to get the right bourbon. And people tend to use cheap bourbons, which makes for a crappy cocktail to make that right. And so, and in fact, our Relativity whiskey that we've got up in the Boston area is really perfect for this cocktail. It nails it. So my way of making it makes it more stable, makes it more robust. You have a better chance of getting it right. Okay. So before you begin, what you're going to do is you're going to make a jalapeno syrup. And the way you're going to do this, and this is, you know, again, a spinoff Edward Lee's version, is you're going to take a half cup of water and a half cup of sugar. Before I get into the recipe, I want to remind folks that in the show notes is a recipe. So while you're driving, I don't want you writing this down.
Or drinking it.
So what we're going to do is, before you begin, what you're going to do is you're going to make the jalapeno syrup. And you're going to do this by mixing together a half cup of water and a half cup of sugar and one jalapeno that you've chopped, seeds and all, because we want the heat out of the seeds. Okay, so you're going to put all of that in a saucepan. You're going to bring it to a boil and then turn off the heat and let it steep for about 20 minutes. Then you're going to strain it, put it in a little plastic container or glass jar, and put it in the fridge so to chill it out. Or if you're in a rush, just use it, whatever. Now, to make the cocktail, you're going to take a rocks glass and you muddle together some mint. And if the leaves are small, I would use 9 leaves. And if they're big ones, I'd use 6. So it's in the 6 to 9. And I'm sorry for the variance, but I'm explaining it to you. It's a good, hefty amount of mint. And you're going to add 1 teaspoon of the jalapeno syrup. 1 teaspoon of jalapeno syrup. And then you're going to – it's called muddle it. And there's special muddlers that have grips on it. But you can also just take a wooden spoon or something. And you really want to mash it good. You want to get the oils out of the mint and the stems. You really want to get that out. Then you add 2 ounces of – in my case, I use our Relativity, the new American whiskey. And if you don't have that, you use a local craft brand. Add crushed ice if you have it. If you don't, some ice cubes. And I stir it my thing is a lucky 13 times I stir it and enjoy. And it's amazing because you get this wonderful tension between the sweet, the mint, the heat, the whiskey. They just work together such that the sum of the parts is much greater than they are individually. It really is amazing. Now, if you want more heat, put in more jalapeno. I originally made it with 2, which was way too much for people. I loved it, but I didn't get many other people having it. And if you want a little less, you can take it down too. You want a little sweet, add more. I tend to like my cocktails to have a touch of sweet, not to be thickly sweet. I'm a little bit on the drier side on all of mine. But it's easy to make it with 1, and if you think that's not enough, add another half a teaspoon or add a full teaspoon until you get to what your thing is. The key with cocktails is make it how you like the taste. And in fact, when I'm sitting there and I'm making cocktails for people, I will make my base one, which tends to be drier, and then people say, would you like a little bit more sweetness? And if it's like a old fashioned, I might add another half teaspoon of simple syrup or jalapeno syrup to it just to sweeten it up a little bit. It's easy to add. It's impossible to take away, obviously.
Really? Wow. And I like sweet. For whatever reason, but I do like the hot, the idea of the hot, and, you know,
the balance, I guess, is the key, according to what you're saying, of the three. And then it's the individual taste.
The big thing I want listeners to take and embrace is the whiskey world has been built under a lot of rules, how you're supposed to drink it, how you have to make it, and traditions. And we've got to blow that up. I mean, this is about what you enjoy. Take control over it. Don't let anybody tell you how to do it. That's why with all of my recipes, I'm going to do it 2 ounces or an ounce and a half. Use rye if you want it whiskey forward. Use bourbon if you want to soften it up a little bit. I mean, I'm going to give you those options because you want to get to your tastes. I mean, because life's meant to be enjoyed, and these are supposed to be fun. You should not, never, ever drink something that doesn't taste good. I've become vicious about it. At restaurants, I always ask for a taste of wines because I'm not going to drink bad wine. I don't drink bad whiskey. I don't eat bad food. I become an old crusty fart, but we can demand in today's world that we get quality products. And so you should make it as you like it. And if you're at a craft bar and you say they make your cocktail and you don't like it, tell them. They want to know that. I can tell you that. They want to know that. Because they'll bring you something else because they want you to be happy. And the more people speak out, then the better quality we're going to get on these things.
And I just want to tie this back into something that you said earlier, which is, getting to a 7 is really hard. And, I just, as you were talking there, I was thinking in terms of, if somebody's not going to like that whiskey or that bourbon just right off the bat, and they're going to get it a 3 or a 4. So now I can kind of understand why it's so hard to get to a 7, never mind a 9 on that particular scale, because you're in essence testing these whiskeys with a variety of different tastes and people. Is that kind of how it goes?
Yeah. I mean, you get a feel for it, but when you start to push the edges, you got to test. You got to test.
This concludes episode 4 of the Driving Eureka podcast. Because we appreciate you as a listener, we are offering for a limited time 4 things. A 1-hour abridged audio of the Driving Eureka book. A subscription to the Driving Eureka newsletter, which contains weekly advice from Doug Hall on how to find, filter, and fast-track big ideas. And the newsletter has other offers that are not made public. The Driving Eureka prescription for success. You answer questions and we'll help you assess your ability to find, filter, and fast-track big ideas. And you get advice on how to grow your ability to innovate. And the last item, access to a Doug Hall interview with a radio legend. To get these offers, go to www.doughall.com/podcast. Subscribe to the Driving Eureka podcast on iTunes.